The Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham, Michael Joseph Limited, London, England, 1951. The type of work is a science fiction narrative set in London, England in the mid-1950s. The principal characters are William Masson, a biologist, the narrator, Josella Platon, a writer, and Coker, a professional speaker and intellectual. "Wednesday, May 8th, was the day I was scheduled to have the bandages removed from my eyes," said William Masson as he began his story. "But when I awoke in my hospital bed to hear the distant clock strike 8, I knew that something was very wrong. By this time, I should have already been washed, dressed, and fed. I rang the service bell to summon a nurse. There was no response. I felt my way to the door and shouted into the hall, only to hear hundreds of babbling voices sound an unintelligible response. I tried to collect my thoughts. I had spent the evening before listening to the nurse's raving accounts of a spectacular meteor shower. What a pity it was that I had to miss it, they kept telling me, but nothing in what they said seemed to tie in with the chaos I now sensed around me. Finally, I reached up to remove the bandages from my eyes. Squinting against the sunlight, I saw a few people wandering aimlessly on the street below. I made my way out into the hall and almost stumbled into a doctor who was reeling blindly toward me. I helped him, ranting and shuddering in pain, to his fifth-floor office, where he grabbed for the telephone. When he found the line dead, he turned before I could stop him and flung himself from the window. Back in the corridors, I dodged between blinded, babbling fugitives and a litter of dead bodies. In the downstairs lobby, a sightless mob groped unsuccessfully for the main doors. I immediately fled. Let me start at the beginning. I had landed in the hospital in the first place due to a triffid sting. You see, I was a biologist involved in triffid research. Years earlier, when the laboratories in communist-ruled Russia attempted to smuggle some triffid seeds out of the country, the jet carrying the seeds had been destroyed as it flew high in the stratosphere. The seeds dispersed by air currents all across the globe spawned a deadly menace. At maturity, the triffids stood some 7 feet tall. They grew roots, so I guess you could call them plants, but they were like no plants anyone had ever seen before. At will, they could pull themselves from the ground and lurch about on 3 leg-like appendages. Even more alarming, the whorl topping every triffid stem could lash out as a slender, stinging weapon 10 feet long, capable of discharging enough poison to kill a man, whereupon it would feed upon its victim's flesh. Scientists immediately launched into the all but impossible task of corralling the triffids, which by now had popped up everywhere. Since they could not easily be destroyed, the captured plants were commonly docked, a safety precaution involving removal of the whorl stinger, or else herded behind enclosures of safety netting. However, because of the valuable oil they produced, triffids by the thousands were soon under cultivation in scores of privately owned nurseries. On one occasion, while I was examining some rather unusual triffid specimens, a stinger had reached out and struck my mask. Poison splashed right through the mesh and blinded me. In fact, only quick medical attention had saved my life. Ironically, I seemed to be the only human creature in the city who could still see. I wandered through the streets, watching as people felt their way down the sidewalks, occasionally colliding with one another. From time to time, they broke into storefronts, searching for food. Then suddenly I heard a scream. I turned to see a woman, her hands tied behind her back, being beaten in an alley. Since her assailant was completely blind, I easily rescued her and was delighted to discover that she too could see. Like me, this young woman had missed the fateful meteor shower. Her name was Josella Platon. She was a writer. Together we commandeered an auto and set out toward her family home. When we arrived, however, we found only decaying corpses strewn upon the floor and several triffids silently roaming the house. With a chill, I recalled the words of one of my co-workers. "I tell you," he had said some days before his death, "a triffid's in a damn sight better position to survive than a blind man." Josella and I drove on to Clerkenwell and supplied ourselves with the best triffid guns and masks in the world. The next morning, we hooked up with a small group of people at the university who, for various reasons, had also missed the meteor shower. Working as a unit, we broke into warehouses and scavenged supplies, loaded up a lorry, and headed out of the city. When night came, we gathered in a small lecture theater and discussed our long-term plans. Eventually, it was decided that we must abandon the blinded masses and work for our own survival. Early the next morning, I woke to shouted warnings. Fire! Fire! Hurrying down a smoke-filled staircase, I tripped and hit my head on the landing. When I again awoke, I found myself a captive. As it turned out, another group, led by a sighted intellectual named Coker, had hatched a plan different from ours. Coker's squads were collecting sighted prisoners to serve as the eyes for a company of blind people, scrounging up food and other necessities for them until help arrived. When and from whom the help would come, however, Coker could not say. My assigned scavenge district was Hampstead, a London suburb. Josella, who had also been captured, was assigned Westminster. Chained between two rough-looking blind attendant guards, my 53-member team went to work. At first, my sightless captors could do virtually nothing without me. Soon, however, we began working as a team, rounding up the often infirm, sightless nomads. On day 5 of my servitude, we came upon another work party, whose sighted guide straightway shot and killed one of my guards. Fearing for my life when the other guard refused to release me, I instantly beat him to the ground, rifled through his pockets for the key, unchained myself, and ran. Returning to base, I discovered that the roving Triffids and bands of human marauders had decimated our group, and many of the survivors were desperately ill with plague-like symptoms. Over the next several hours, most of them died or deserted the base. I knew the end for all of us was not far distant. By the next morning, only the dead and the dying and I remained. Hoping to find Josella, I headed towards Westminster. When I arrived, however, I spotted only an occasional Triffid and a random blind scavenger weakly stumbling about. No Josella. Even the university had been abandoned. It was then that I again ran into Coker. Desolated, he admitted that he had been wrong. It's just that he couldn't believe that some kind of help wouldn't come. Coker and I finally scouted out another band of sighted survivors at Tinsham, led by a Miss Durant. She reported that my original group, having rejected her ultra-religious brotherly philosophies, had gone on to Bemminster some weeks earlier. Trudging to Bemminster, Coker and I merged with a trio of sighted men, a remnant of one of his squads of hopefuls, and together we searched the countryside. Isolated bands of survivors huddled together for protection, but still there was no sign of the person who was uppermost in my own heart, Josella. Coker's plan was a return to Tinsham. But suddenly I remembered that Josella had said something about going down to Sussex Downs. So while the rest of our group proceeded toward Tinsham, I, in a crush of loneliness, headed for Sussex to find Josella. Miraculously, she was there. My arms went around her in a relief that was too vast for words. After we stopped hugging and kissing long enough to speak, we shared our hair-raising stories. When Coker's group was overwhelmed by a combination of Triffids and plague, Josella had made a terrified beeline for Sussex, the home of her friends, Dennis and Mary Brent, who were now with her and expecting a baby at any time. Several weeks later, I returned to Tinsham to see Coker, only to find that both his and Durant's group had been obliterated. Apparently, the typhoid-like plague had taken its terrible toll. By the time I returned to Sussex, Mary's baby had been born. A few months later, Josella bore our own son, David. We spent the next several years at Sussex, frequently making runs into the nearby towns and cities to forage for the essentials that couldn't be grown on the land. Our only danger now came from the ever-present Triffids pushing at our fenced perimeter. Over the years, we came up with some ingenious schemes to kill or trap them, but none became a viable solution. The plants seemed uncannily capable of learning from their mistakes. Then in our fourth year at Sussex, a man by the name of Ivan, the friend of Coker's, appeared, piloting a helicopter. Ivan reported that Coker, who had survived the plague, had abandoned Tinsham when the epidemic struck. After eventually locating my original university group, which had established itself on the Isle of Wight, Coker sent Ivan to find us and bring us to join them on the island. We decided to go in the fall after spending one last summer at Sussex. But as it turned out, we were never to see Coker again. Droves of soldiers who had spotted the smoke given off by the burning logs we had used to signal the helicopter arrived in their half-tracks the following day. Their intentions were both simple and terrible. 17 blind superintendents were to join us at Sussex. The soldiers spoke proudly of being the first country to get on its feet. Indeed, they offered me an administrative post if I would aid their efforts. I pretended to warm to their sinister plan. That night we even threw a party for our guests. But then, at the height of the celebration, I slipped out and filled all but one of the vehicle's fuel tanks with honey. Finally, as the soldiers slept, we made our break in the one honeyless half-track. As we smashed through the fences of our enclosed compound, the Triffids suddenly became our rescuers. Through the breach they filed, heading for the soldiers who sat wide-eyed in their stalled vehicles. And there my personal story joins up with the rest, William Masson ended his narrative. You will find it in Elspeth Carey's excellent History of the Colony. Written in 1951 at the dawn of the Cold War era, John Wyndham's The Day of the Triffids painted a dark portrait of humanity's future, a future filled with bizarre adversaries and horrific diseases. The blinding meteor shower and resultant mysterious plague, Wyndham implies, might actually have been the result of malfunctioning military missiles or satellites armed with deadly bacteria colonies. And the Triffids themselves were probably developed by the Soviets for use as secret weapons. Some of Wyndham's doomsday pessimism can be attributed to the general aura of McCarthy-era paranoia that hovered over the early 50s. However, his assertion that a militant 5% of the world's population keeps the other 95% living in fear is as true today as it was then. And despite the powerful developed countries' claims that their defensive weapons are safely stored and in competent hands, we can never really know for sure.